Welcome, everyone, on this bright and beautiful morning filled with beautiful music and beautiful people. Let us take a moment to turn to our neighbors, turn to those people we don't know, and see the goodness in their eyes. I welcome everyone to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan, Kansas. If you are interested in finding out more about what it means to be a Unitarian Universalist, this afternoon at 12:15, we will have a 40-45 minute class session discussing, looking, feeling, thinking, trying to figure out what does it mean to be a Unitarian Universalist. This morning is a particularly important morning in the cycle of time in this year. Let us light the chalice for the four girls that were killed 50 years ago by a bomb placed in the church by men from the Ku Klux Klan in Birmingham. Let us honor Addie Mae Collins, Cynthia Wesley, Carol Denise McNair, and Carol Robertson by living lives led by a vision that celebrates the diversity of life and challenges us and encourages us to do work that lifts up the goodness of what it means to be human. Now let us stand as you are able and let us sing opening hymn number 6, Just As Long As I Have Breath. Welcome, everyone. It is that crazy Sunday when the time changes, hard to get up. But welcome. Welcome, everyone. All right. I draw your attention to the announcements in our order of service. These are some of the things that give structure and meaning to our everyday lives as a community. Ours is a welcoming community where we find connection, a loving community where we find meaning. Ours is a sharing community where our joys are amplified, a caring community where our sorrows are lessened. We take this moment to reflect on our joys and sorrows and to acknowledge the mutual support of all of our friends here. If you would like, please now share a brief personal joy or sorrow, or that wonderful mix if you feel so moved. Who's got the mic? All right, William.
Dick and I are really lucky to have a visiting student, Aya Nakayama from Kyushu University, and she's studying at K-State for a few weeks and staying with us for a week. So we're really happy to have her.
Hi, I'm Charlie Kempthorne. We've been gone 95 days and 8,000 miles, and it's good to be back. We spent most of our time in the Pacific Northwest in the city of 10 million or whatever it is, Seattle, and went to the Saltwater UU Church there. And it's interesting to see how all of us Unitarians are evolving and doing lots of singing. It's good to be back. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Dave Lambert. This is one of those mixed joys and concerns. Tomorrow morning, about this time, Sybil will be coming out of having her knee replaced. So all of your thoughts in support of her recovery are appreciated.
Chris Bailey, and I had the privilege and pleasure of talking with some other Unitarians from this congregation over the weekend, and we were talking about the way things are in Kansas right now, and the concern was raised that, you know, boy, we might just have to move to Canada, we might just have to leave this, you know, and I didn't feel pompous when I said it, but I allowed as how this was my home, and I felt incumbent on me to stay and just not leave. But the response I got was, but we have children, and there aren't going to be any art programs in the school, and the music's going away, and that took me down a notch. I'd just like to remind everybody that the arts don't just happen all on their own. When I was in college, it was support your local music scene. And I just have to urge everybody to please remember we're not utterly dependent on government. Please support your local arts scene. It exists, and it needs us now more than ever.
My name is Catherine, and a good friend of mine, she's been sick a long time, and I just found out Friday night she passed, so I'm kind of sad.
I'm Edith Hendricks, and I'm sad to say I'm leaving on Tuesday, going back to a state that is in just as bad a shape. Alabama is in as bad a shape as Kansas is, but the people here are wonderful, and I'm hoping to join them permanently soon. So think hard and work hard here, and I will when I come.
May we remember those who have spoken, those they have named, the issues they care about, And those we hold in silence in our hearts, knowing each of us carry unspoken joys and unspoken sorrows. Be mindful, be compassionate. All right, Sandy.
Children, let's read a story. Good morning, Arthur. Is it pajama day? It's pajama day. Did anybody else wear their pajamas? No. It looks like everybody had kind of a pajama day today. I might need an older kid sitting over here today. Thank you. Can I have the bucket? What is this? Whoa! Wake up! It's a what? It's a metal bucket. Have we read a story about filling buckets? Okay, keep that in your head. Will you hold the bucket for me? Thank you. Did I do that right? Did I turn it off or anything? No, good. Oh, thank you, Doug. Okay, this morning I'm going to read, oh, look at that, a story called Ordinary Mary's Extraordinary Deed. Now, I know we've read this before, but it's one of those that you want to read over and over and over, or remind yourself of over and over, and you've never read it, is that right? And you've never read it, okay. And I bet there's some folks out there who don't know the story either. So, this story has some numbers in it, and the number 5 plays a big role. And Leah is holding the bucket, and she will hold it up high, and she might have to pass it around a little. And Lily has, can I have one or two? Let me pass them around. She has some circles, whoa, that are really light and fall. And she now is going to quietly give everybody probably 5 or so circles, okay? So you guys can have some of these. These are not blueberries. They're like paper blueberries. This is important. And when I say something that sounds like it's time to place our blueberries into the bucket, I want you guys to put your blueberries in the bucket. Please. Ordinary Mary was so very ordinary that you'd never guess she could change the world. This ordinary kid, she did. She changed the world. One ordinary day, skipping on her way home from school, her ordinary school, she passed an ordinary house on an ordinary vacant lot filled with ordinary bushes, growing ordinary berries, ordinary blue and juicy, luscious, lovely berries, blueberries. I think it's the furnace that just turned on. Well, Ordinary Mary picked the ordinary berries and brought them in a big brown bowl to Mrs. Bishop's porch. What? Left berries in a big brown bowl on Mrs. Bishop's porch? That sneaky kid, she did. This made Mrs. Bishop very, very happy. So she baked a big batch of blueberry muffins and thought of 5 people who might have brought those beautiful berries that then she secretly gave each a plate. How great. 5 people got a plate. Let's put 5 in the bucket. One of those was her paper boy, Billy Parker. And when Billy saw his name on a note in the driveway on a plate, he quickly parked his bike and ate every crumb. Yum, yum, yum. He ate every crumb. This made him so glad that the next five people got their newspapers on the porch, not in the bushes where he usually throws them. In fact, he handed them right to each person. What did I say? Five people? Let's put five more in the bucket, at least. Here. I only need five, so just put one. There's more kids. One of those five was Mr. Stevens, who was so amazed that he smiled for 10 hours on the airplane. Then, to five different people with heavy bags, he said, "Here, let me help you." He still smiled, and they did too. And one of those five more, one of those five was Maria, whose cranky little boy James stopped crying when Mr. Williams played peekaboo with him until their ride came. When he waved goodbye, Maria exclaimed, "How strange that a stranger would be so sweet." And the next day, when she was out shopping, once, twice, five times, I need five more. Who needs papers? She did something nice for five different people. I need five more. Without stopping, one of those five was Joseph, an old bent and gray man in front of her in line at the produce stand. And when he said, "I guess I counted wrong, I don't really need these oranges," little James reached out to him with an orange from their basket, and Maria put a coin in Joseph's hand, and he said, "Here, take this. The oranges are on us." As Joseph shuffled to the bus, his heart was full and his eyes were wet, and his hands did helpful things for the next five people he met. Let's fill up the bucket. One of those five was Sarah, a college girl who was off to see the world and stopped at Joseph's shop. When her bag broke and things fell all over the floor, she said, "Oh, what will I do?" Joseph said, "This is for you." He gave her a new bag woven with his own hands in red and purple and green. "Oh, thank you," she said. "It's the loveliest bag I've ever seen." When Sarah left, she felt sunny as noon, and she just had to shine on five people soon. One of those five was Sophia, whom she met on a boat, looking like the world might end, looking like someone without a friend. "What beautiful blue eyes you have," Sarah said, "and they're just the color of the flowers in your lovely dress." "Yes," said Sophia, "the beautiful blue eyes shed a happy tear." And when the boat trip was through, Sophia called five people to make them happy, too. One of those five was Tom, her son, the doctor, who was having a very hard day. "Hi," she said, "I love you, Tom." "Well, how great to hear your voice," he sighed. "I always need my mom." Dr. Tom was so cheered up that on his next break, he bought a big bunch of bright balloons for five young patients, and he handed them out right then and there. One of those five was Peter, a little boy who went home from the hospital that very day. Gratitude for the big bunch of bright balloons filled him and thrilled him and spilled out of him onto the next five people who came his way. One of those five was Eric, a teenage boy whose sacks and such were way too much. When one dropped on the sidewalk, Peter stopped his play and rushed right over, saying, "Super wheels to the rescue!" Well, Eric, no longer stressed, was very impressed and made a mental note that very afternoon to help five people, and do it soon. One of those five was Di, his 10-year-old sister who didn't have many friends and was painfully shy. When Eric said, "Hey, sis, want to come to the park and play and learn how to ride my skateboard?" She looked at him wide-eyed. "Serious?" she cried. "Sure," he said. And because of her brother, Di decided maybe she could be a friend to another five others. How's our bucket? One of those five was Louise, a homeless woman who lived under the trees. She could hardly believe her ears when she heard Di say, May my brother and I buy you a hot dog and a drink at that stand over there. Could it be true someone actually cared enough to give her food and smiley-faced ring that was practically new? Louise was so pleased that she decided that even though she had nothing, she would find five others and give them something. One of those five was Mr. Taylor, who lost his wallet in the park. Louise found it full of fives and tens and twenties. Oh, what she could do with all that money, but she found his name and called his home, and over he came. He was so impressed that she was honest in spite of being poor that he offered her a job in his store and vowed to do something generous for five people more. One of those five was Kate, a woman on vacation who wanted to see a show she'd heard was a sensation. Oh, no, she said. It's sold out. But I'm going home tomorrow, and her face filled with sorrow. Mr. Taylor held out his ticket. I live here, he said. I can go any time. Take mine. Kate loved the show and was so touched that she thought buying five presents for five people back home would really be fun. And one of those five presents was a little heart necklace for Mary, her niece. And you should have seen her eyes light up in surprise. Mary, what? Ordinary Mary? Yes, ordinary. Mary's extraordinary deed had come full circle, and on its way, it had changed the lives of every person living. You see, when Mrs. Bishop made five muffins from Mary's blueberries, not only the paper boy, Billy Parker, but the other four people, too, made five people smile, and those five did too. And after a while, in only 15 days, love was sent to every person everywhere. Just see how it went. Anybody been calculating? Well, we filled up a bucket with just a few pages, didn't we? So see, it goes from one to 5, to 25, and then 125, and 625, and 390,000, and there's 48. I can't, just six, what is that, six?
6 billion
times. And I couldn't punch that many pieces of paper this morning. But, you guys get the idea? Yeah. So it would take a long time for one person to do a 6 billion things. But if you only do five, then the next person could do just five. So what's maybe one a day for a week? Shall we start today? I hate that rhyme. Shall we start today? Okay.
Go in love, our hearts go with you. Go in joy, our hopes go through. Learn in love and grow in wisdom. Shine your light in all you do. Go in love, our hearts go with you.
So our Helping Hands today is Wonder Workshop that's run by Richard Pitts. Everyone who knows him knows that this is a great, great gift to Manhattan, celebrating diversity, celebrating giving everyone a good chance. So Richard, come up and share. For those of you who don't know him, this is Richard Pitts.
Thanks for having me back. For those of you who have never been to the Wonder Workshop Children's Museum, it's located at 506 South 4th Street. It's right across the street from the Hilton Garden Inn, and the city just built a new garage on that end of town on 4th Street in Yuma. Well, it's been almost a year since I've been here, and in that year, we've done some remarkable things with the helping hands of folks right in this room. No one can ever do anything by themselves. I never believed in that bootstrap nonsense. My thought has always been has been to connect with people who are like-minded and get things done. We took a building down on 4th Street that was slated to be destroyed and refurbished it from the basement all the way up to the attic. We've created exhibits within that space and exhibits outside that space that are free to the public 24/7. Our outdoor exhibits currently, there are water elements, there are climbing structures, there's a paleontology dig area, there is a garden. Of course, it's not blooming now, but soon it will be. There are birds out there. We have a second location out on Tuttle Creek where we take children and let them play like I used to play in nature growing up in New Jersey. The kids are out there. They can ride our zip line. They can go climb to the top of our treehouse on a climbing wall or take the steps up. There's trampoline. A tightrope, but it's not far off the ground. It's only 2 feet off the ground. That goes 45 yards. And kids can build different forts and stuff. And some of you, anybody here ever built a fort when they were a kid? Well, kids need to do that. I believe that. And let them have some free time as well as some structured activities out there and enjoy nature. We were able to make these connections only through partnerships, like with UUFM here and different folks at the university and different folks in the community who have come and helped out. We are poor. We are a children's museum, and children's museums historically have always been in large cities. But we thought that our kids needed to have hands-on education too. So, and we knew that we could do that back in 1989, and we have so far succeeded in doing it, and only through our partnerships that we are able to do that. Last year, we didn't want our children's museum to be something just for people who could afford our fees. So we came to you and asked you for a helping hand. And you provided $700 in helping hand to the Wonder Workshop Children's Museum. We, in turn, scholarship 22 children in our after-school program, in our summer program, and in programs we call Discovery Days when there's no school or schools released early due to teacher conferences or whatever. Your money has put a smile on so many kids. It means a lot. Currently, just so you know, we have two new exhibits at our Children's Museum. One is called The Doctor's Inn, where kids can go in and they're in a doctor's office and they can do all the things that they see doctors do without the needles and the hard stuff and the medicines. But they can do some role-playing and don on costumes. And our biggest and newest exhibit is called Beyond the Wall, Coming Together as One, the Human Race, where we explore how race has divided us over the years and why it has divided us over the years and who are some of these folks who have come together to make the playing field a little bit more level. And we talk about African American, Euro American, Native American, Asian American, and Latino American. Because far too often our kids do not have the opportunity to see us working together, but they see a lot of stuff on TV that keeps us separated and polarized. I invite you all to come down. Both exhibits reopen up this Saturday if you have the opportunity. My last thought again is please be generous. We take the money that you provide us and share it with our kids. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Why I Believe Life is Good. Well, I thought it was a good title, and then I started thinking about it, and I thought, how am I going to tell people why and how I think life is good? And so yesterday evening, as the sun was doing its magical thing, I was inspired to pull out Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, a great inspirational book. Now, I'd like to read a passage from it. This intensification of inner life helped the prisoner find a refuge from the emptiness, desolation, and spiritual poverty of his existence by letting him escape into the past. When given free rein, his imagination played with past events, often not important ones, but minor happenings and trifling things. His nostalgic memory glorified them and assumed a strange character. Their world and their existence seemed very distant, and the spirit reached out for them longingly. In my mind, I took bus rides, unlocked the front door of my apartment, answered the phone, switched on the electric lights. Our thoughts often centered on such details. And these memories could move one to tears. As the inner life of the prisoner tended to become more intense, he also experienced the beauty of art and nature as never before. Under the influence, he sometimes even forgot his own frightful circumstances. If someone had seen our faces on the journey from Auschwitz to the Bavarian camp as we beheld the mountains of Salzburg with their summits glowing in the sunset, through the little barred windows of the prison carriage, he would never have believed that those were the faces of men who had given up all hope of life and liberty. Despite that factor, or maybe because of it, we were carried away by nature's beauty, which we had missed for so long. In camp two, a man might draw the attention of a comrade working next to him to a nice view of the setting sun shining through the tall trees of the Bavarian woods, the same woods in which we had built an enormous hidden munitions plant. So, if people who can only see their death coming can find beauty in the simple sunset, cannot we also open ourselves up to the great mystery and majesty of this life? I was born an optimist, and I will die an optimist. My life, like everybody else's, has cycled through shame, defeat, despair, acute sense of hopelessness. But give me a freshwater lake on a summer day. The heaviness lifts as I move through the water, feeling like a dolphin or an otter or a happy sea lion. I love how water holds me up, the way it refreshes me with its gift of fluidity, how when swimming underwater, the sunlight refracts and blurs into gem-like colors, the soft glow filling your body with this wonderful motion. In our psyches, there are these spots marked before and after. That place where one's understanding of the world shifts dramatically. The point from which there is no turning back. You will never be the same again. I recall the first time this happened to me. It began with the most horrendous earaches imaginable. I can remember riding home with the family in our car on a Sunday afternoon from my grandparents' house, screeching at the top of my lungs because the pain in my ears was so horrible. So, of course, the answer was for me to have my tonsils taken out. I remember going into the hospital in Chicago, feeling strange, but okay, this has got to be done. I remember when that mask came towards my nose and mouth, and I could begin to smell the chloroform. I began to feel the most unbelievable fear and terror. I was sure I was going to die. I was freaking out as I went to sleep. I woke up as the sun was gathering on a late winter afternoon, and a room that was institutional green. The ceilings were high, the floors were waxed, and they were shining dully and oddly and weirdly, and you could hear the screech of nurses' shoes on that linoleum on those tiles. And my mother was sitting next to me, and she said, "I have to go soon." And then I just drifted off back to sleep. A little while later, I woke up and it was completely dark, and the pain in my throat was burning so bad I thought again I would die, and I started screaming, "Mom! Mom! Mom!" And a nurse in a very crisp white uniform and a starched hat marched into my room and said, "Young man, there are no mothers after dark." Until that day, I had lived in a world I trusted and felt secure in exploring. I understood that world, but I did not understand this new world in which I had no control over what happened to me. A world in which people who did not love me had absolute control over me. That I could be abandoned, left alone in the world. I had been a happy child until that point. Normal weight, active, involved, and just carefree. After that, things began to shift. I started to gain weight. In 1984, the Italian writer Italo Calvino, in his 6 memos for the next millennium, writes 5 essays in the 6 I'll talk about later. These pithy, enchanting, exacting essays explore the qualities of lightness, quickness, exactitude, visibility, and multiplicity. If he had lived, if he hadn't had a brain aneurysm that just shut down his life, he would have written the 6th, consistency. He wrote, "Whenever humanity seems condemned to heaviness, I think I should fly like Perseus into a different space. I have to change my approach. Look at the world from a different perspective, with a different logic, and with fresh methods of cognition and verification." In this essay on lightness, Calvino thinks about Lucretius, a Roman philosopher and poet who lived from 99 BC to 55 BC. He says of his De Rerum Natura, on the nature of things, that it is the first great work of poetry in which knowledge of the world tends to dissolve the solidity of the world. It is the first great poem to dissolve the solidity of the world, leading to a perception of all that is infinitely minute, light, and mobile. Lucretius believed that the universe was made and is made of invisible things. His chief concern is to prevent the weight of matter from crushing us. He feels the need to allow atoms to make unpredictable deviations from the straight line, thereby ensuring freedom to both atoms and to human beings. The connection. The poetry of the invisible, of infinite unexpected possibilities, even the poetry of nothingness, issues from a poet who had no doubts whatsoever about the physical reality of the world, little motes of dust swirling in a shaft of sunlight in a dark room, the minuscule shells, all similar but each one different, the waves cast up upon the imbibing sand, or the spider web that wraps themselves around us without our noticing as we walk along. The world is real. No aspect of it can be discounted. The good and bad stuff, the malicious as well as the sweetest gesture. In Guanajuato, we were not so very far from where those 43 male students from the Rural Teachers College disappeared last year. They were brutally murdered for protesting against the provincial government's hiring policies of teachers. The simple act of protest meant the death of these 43 young men. This outrages Mexicans, because they live in a culture where politicians colluding with gangs to kill have a lot of power and create a lot of fear, but it doesn't stop them from enjoying or appreciating life. It doesn't mean small acts of kindness stop. It's mostly poor women who carry the baskets of chiclets, those little wrapped gums, and boxes of matches to sell. You don't see the gringos giving a couple of pesos for something they don't really need, but the locals often do. You may ask, how is this going to help? And before waiting for an answer, you think, no, it's not really going to help. They don't need to do that. But you see, they do need to do it. They need to help their brothers and sisters. It is in their heart to do so. Charles came home early one evening from a walk with one avocado in his hand. I looked at him and I asked, Chuck, we have lots of avocados. Why do you have just one avocado? We don't need another one. He said, well, when I was walking up to Cayon, which is the alley that rises up the mountain to the place that we were living, an old, tiny woman bent over, sitting on the side of the road, had three avocados, holding them out whomever walked by. Chuck bought one. He spent 5 pesos, 33 cents. We ate a lot of avocados, but I tell you, that was the best damn avocado we ate in the 6 weeks we were there. Seeking to make sense out of my world after my loss of trust in the everyday reality and how it worked and how I fit into it, I began to seek solitude. I wanted and needed to be away from everything. this was not always easy to do on the edge of a bustling, growing city like Chicago. But I found my sanctuaries. I remember it must have been the same year that I had had my tonsillectomy. It was spring, late April. And we had finished dinner and we had done our dishes and I ran out of the house and I found a tree. A tree that overlooked the schoolyard where little leagues were playing and there were people swinging in the distance up and down trying to do one of those things to go around, which was very dangerous, but of course it was the highlight. And kids on training wheels, kids pulling wagons, and Mrs. Foss with her Scotty looking in every single window snooping to see if there isn't some gossip she could get so she could share. It was our neighborhood alive. But I rose up into this tree and found a branch and leaned my body against the trunk. And it's with that time when the leaves are just coming out of the trees. They're like rabbit fur almost. And the catkins, the little flowers, and the pollen is there, and the light is beginning to glow with that golden hued color that comes at dusk in spring, making the green brighter and softer. I closed my eyes. I felt how beautiful the world was and is. And in my right ear, it was as if a voice were speaking to me. This world is beautiful. This world is beautiful. This world is so beautiful. Be here. Be in this beautiful world. And by the way, it's the same ear out of which the thunder blew when Chuck and I were hit by lightning. So this ear seems to be very weird. So I rediscover the possibility of magic and living by lifting myself up above all that was going around, not condemning it, but just being above it in my safe place. Calvino, his choice for an image that is auspicious, one that encourages lifting up into the new millennium. We're always lifting up into a new millennium, a new phase of living. He says, the sudden agile leap of the poet philosopher who raises himself above the weight of the world, showing that with all the gravity that he has, the secret of lightness, and that what many consider to be the vitality of the times, noisy, aggressive, revving, and roaring, belongs to the realm of death like a cemetery of rusting cars. A good life does not fear the sufferings of love, human tragedy. It is not the heaviness of things that weigh us down, that bring true meaning to our lives. Rather, it is the capacity to dissolve. Sometimes in what can't really be seen. That which moves with ease between the sensitive soul and the sensitive intellect, between heart and mind, between eyes and voice, there is a lightness of being in motion, containing multitudes. There is the infinite tension between the small and large, the visible and the invisible. If we only think in concrete terms, we are by definition rigid. The imagination is one of the greatest gifts of life. It is the source of the greatest human expressions found in music and physics, painting and medicine, great architecture and mathematics, between father and daughter and son, mother and her teenage daughter, the adult child tenderly sitting with a dying parent. If one lacks access to the imagination, if the gateways are locked and closed and shut, the ability to solve personal or global problems diminishes. Gloom and doom becomes the rule. It becomes a foregone conclusion. We can't see our way out of darkness. Unitarian Universalism's radical shift from a hell-dominated theology and damnation invites us to stay open to the profound and the smallest moments it can be found. It nudges us to focus on the potential of the good humans can do instead of fixating on their limitations. Our liberal heritage seeks free and liberating access to wisdom, the will and the lightness of being to unchain ourselves from heavy, heavy dogma that tells us that we're not good. For Calvino, lightness should not be confused with the fuzzy, empty wishes, an approach to life that says, oh, everything will be all right if I think it's going to be okay. I just have to imagine. I just have to visualize. Well, those are good things, but it's not enough. Calvino believed that true lightness comes from precision and determination and should not be confused with what is vague and haphazard. One should be like a bird and not a feather, said Paul Valéry. Emily Dickinson is a fine example of someone who knew exactly what she was writing, yet she did it with subtle weightlessness that signified deep feeling and a deep sensing of the world. Her love of the world made so disruptively evident. A sepal, a petal, and a thorn. Upon a common summer's morn, a flask of dew, a bee or two, a breeze, a caper in the trees, and I'm a rose. The framework is impeccable, and the accomplishment not accidental, but miraculous. She is aware of the subtle forces that connect macrocosm to microcosm. The lens narrowly focused, opening to the wonder of the world. Seeing oneself as the rose. This leap of imagination frees her from an identity separated from the world, even though she lived as a recluse. She celebrates the expansive unity through intimate, dynamic, and loving inspection. She clarified her gifts through applying all of her faculties to developing her voice, her particular temple, her way of seeing and saying it slant. It takes moral courage to believe in goodness, in the goodness of the life that we have to live. It sometimes seems to me it is the coward's way to see no hope, to live half-heartedly because life lacks meaning. Yes, we all have moments when we give in to despair. It's important to look closely at reality. The facts and their details can become dead weight, as they did for Martin Luther King 50 years ago when everything was going the wrong way and the March on Selma, the work for civil rights, was just at a standstill and he was ready to give up. He said, I have had enough. I have had enough. I cannot do one more thing. And then suddenly people rose up from all over the United States and descended on Selma and marched with him. Many UUs joined in that march. And it reinvigorated him. It re-inspired. It made the civil rights march move on. He did not give up. How, in the face of war, its brutality, the greed that drives the angry engine of climate change, the pettiness, the mean-spiritedness, the closed-heartedness, we can offer at least as much or more than those people in Auschwitz who celebrated beauty when they got the chance. And it allowed them to see beyond what was most likely their intimate death. Calvino says of Isaac Newton's theories, what most strikes the literary imagination is not the conditioning of everyone by the inevitability of its own weight, but rather the balance of forces that enables heavenly bodies to float in space. I would like to end with a poem that I wrote that celebrates hundreds of thousands of years of artistic imagination, the petroglyph. The petroglyph tells its story. Eventually, I come to Big Creek, where time stops to tell you how time fills with time, how the rocks are filled with wings, at least 25 kinds of birds, and flight above all that happens then and now. Rocks that tell the story of how Deer Prince began as song in the air and now live in sandstone. How the opossum, lizard, two snakes, and a turtle listen endlessly for this life that goes on inside the mind of creation and urges us to say again the names of all the children, to remember again how it all began, shadow of hawk, eagle, the split tail of the swallow, water breaking onto the ground, how daughter became mother, became a craving for more, the little one hungry for all the names, to learn how one shape fits inside another, crawls away from what she knows to test the taste of dirt, to see how mud feels between her toes, to know how in the end words always fail, the answer always beyond reach, the sky instructing us to fly. So, we have a few minutes for sharing. What are those moments in your life when you have felt like you have been instructed to fly, even though you know that it's probably not possible, but it becomes possible in its own way? The magic in the moment.
I lost my home and everything in the fires of 08 in Santa Barbara. And shortly after that, I went through a divorce. And so that was, you know, coming out of the ashes, literally. And it was just one of the best learning experiences of my life. And to really find all the beauty and all the little details and be present in the moment is what I learned from that.
This year, I was diagnosed with colon cancer. And I felt so sorry for myself, and I said, oh, my gosh, I don't want to live. I'm ready to go. And then the love that poured out from my family and friends, going to Houston, to MD Anderson, and seeing people who had less hope than I did have the kind of spirit that made me want to fly and gave me hope. And I tell you what, I truly do believe that love is the most powerful force in the universe because it turned me totally around. I'm very thankful.
While you're close by, this is a non sequitur, but I remembered after we were singing the children out that the it is the name of the piece is the Reeb Children's Benediction. And 50 years ago today or yesterday, Unitarian Universalist minister Jim Reeb was killed in Selma. The name got this way because one of our congregations is now known as the James Reeb Memorial UU Congregation. And the minister of music there, who's now a minister of everything, wrote this piece and named it and dedicated it to Jim Reeb.
Right.
Something to think about every Sunday when we sing the kids out.
So out of an act of pure violence, he was beaten on the head with a club from someone who ran out of a hardware store and just knocked him dead. Love rises in the form of music.
Long time ago, when I was a young woman, I was carrying my second child, a little boy, and he was full term, and I went to the hospital for him to be delivered, and through a series of horrible circumstances, he died. And so my husband and I were shattered. I guess I still feel sad. But I realized I didn't want to be anybody else. And we felt so alive, by contrast. And that event changed my whole life, the direction of how I led my life, what I would do professionally. And I think about it a lot. It's still with me.
I just wanted to reiterate with what Richard said, that when I was very ill, I felt that love too, and it made a huge difference in my recovery, and it really just made me feel there was a whole, just sort of a plasma circling us that sort of vibrates when we are loved, and it makes a huge difference for healing and everyday living. But also, one of my favorite quotes that I went to a conference, and the speaker said one of the best things that we can teach young people to help them take power over their own life is that you are the only person who will be with you for the rest of your life. So take care of that person. And I think that really is very, very helpful.
Michaela Sievers. So hearing everybody talk about being supported by everyone around them and sharing the love with all of that, I don't know the precise wording of the quote, but one of the ones that I've come across more recently that I really like is that you'll always have love if you're the one giving love. So really appreciating every chance that you have to brighten somebody else's day and pass along those five random acts of kindness really make a difference.
I'd just like to second Michael's reading of that Viktor Frankl book, Man's Search for Meaning. As soon as you mentioned it, I knew what quote you were going to use, because it meant a lot to me too, that prisoners in the death camps in Nazi Germany could, by calling their comrades' attention to a sunset, get through another day. I can't say happily, but somehow authentically, there were real people. They weren't just there weren't just victims. I've always found that a very powerful image, and I've given that book to an awful lot of high school graduates, and I commend it to everybody else as a source of, well, a little bit more understanding about our own search for meaning in our lives.
Hi, I'm June Kempthorne. In January, I had a really bad fall, and my face was covered with blood, especially the right side or left side. And my granddaughter, who is 2.5, walked to me after I was patched up and went to my good eye and looked right in it and said, "Grandma, are you okay?"
Okay, thank you everyone for sharing. And just to pick up a little bit on what Larry said real quickly is that those people, when they were taking in beauty, no matter how it was, if they shared a piece of bread, were no longer victims. They had taken full control over their lives. And even they were living in the most desperate circumstances, they were in control. So let us now stand as you are able and sing our closing hymn, number 322, Thanks Be for These. Let me share these words from Theodore Parker, the great Unitarian who worked tirelessly to free the slaves. Be ours a religion like sunshine goes everywhere. It's a temple, all space. It's shrine, the good heart. It's creed, all truth. It's ritual, works of love. It's profession of faith, divine living. Let us go and live divinely.